Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner. I'm your host, Trey Walsh, and our guests today really need no introduction, probably for most of you who have listened to our show before and in the Bitcoin space. But we have Troy Cross and Margot Paez on the show. Now, Troy is a professor of philosophy and humanities at Reed College, and Margot is a PhD candidate at the Georgia Institute for Technology and Civil Engineering. And they come on the show today to talk all about Bitcoin mining. They talk about the Bitcoin policy summit that just happened recently at the time of this recording. And what's funny is we were actually going to talk quite a bit about the halving in this episode, considering this episode, as you'll see, is shortly after the halving that we just had. But actually, we ended up talking quite a bit about climate action, about climate change, about our climate crisis, Bitcoin mining, narratives, research. And it was such a good conversation that I just kept it going in that direction and felt that that was really important for this conversation and for both of their time as well and for our audience. So we kept going with that for this entire conversation. And it was such a good conversation that I know you all are going to love. So feel free to dig into this one, share it widely, especially with those friends of yours that are environmentalists, progressives, folks on the left that really unsure of Bitcoin. Well, we talk a lot about Bitcoin as climate action in this episode and the time to take action and how to take action with market incentives and things like that, because we can't really sit around anymore. We need to take action on these things. So this was a really good conversation where we focus a lot on that again, I know you all are going to love. So thanks so much for tuning in, for listening. If you can share this episode, if you can like and subscribe as well on YouTube across our pod channels, that would do a lot for us. You can check out our Geyser Fund as well in the show notes to support the show. And as always, any of our promo links that are in our show notes to support our sponsors, their products, and also support the show in return. All right, I'll keep this one brief so we can jump into this great conversation. But enjoy this episode, and we'll see you all again next week. Hey, Margo. Hey, Troy. Welcome to the Progressive Bitcoiner. How are you both doing?
I'm good. How are you, Troy?
I'm doing well. Nice to talk to you, Trey. Thanks for having us on.
Likewise. And we were talking before the recording that, you know, we'll try not to get tripped up with the Trey and the Troy throughout the conversation, having us both on the show. But yeah, really excited to have you both on. For folks listening, we're recording this a little bit before the halving, about a week and a half, actually about a week probably, before the actual halving. And this episode, as you're listening, is the Tuesday after the halving. So as I was saying, assuming everyone's still here post the halving and, you know, nothing cataclysmic has happened, you know, post halving, this is the show where we'll be talking about the halving. This is shortly after the Bitcoin policy summit as well that you both were at. And we've been sharing a lot from the podcast and so many others have been sharing as well. So just want to start there with the Bitcoin policy summit. How was that for you both? I know a lot of work went into that from BPI. From what I observed through the live stream, it seemed like a really, really awesome event. And I've been telling people, I think it's one of the best events of the year in Bitcoin. A lot of signal, as we say, in that event. But just want to get your pulse check on it. Like, how was that for you all? You know, what was that like prepping for it and jumping into it? I think a lot of people got a lot out of that event. Well, we'll start with you, Troy.
Sure. Well, I think it was just the best event I've been to. Maybe that's my own bias showing, but I've been a part of a lot of Bitcoin events, and generally Bitcoin events are made for Bitcoiners. We are a tribe. And so Bitcoin events are a chance to see people in your tribe, connect, bond over shared experiences, and also work to build things. And so there's a lot of networking that happens at Bitcoin events where you figure out ways to cooperate. But this policy summit had a completely different focus. Focus was on outsiders, and not just any outsiders, but regulators in particular. It's in DC. And we had, what do we have, Margo? Three senators speak, and two congressional reps were there. So we had a sizable representation from government. We had a lot of agency people there. And this was a chance to talk across the divide of the Bitcoin world and the DC world. And so that called for a different kind of programming, different kinds of conversations. And I mean, it's absolutely essential because a lot of the people regulating Bitcoin don't know a lot about it. So they are regulating in the dark. And many of them will even say this, that they feel like they don't know a lot about Bitcoin and digital assets. So I think they appreciate the chance to talk to people. And also, it depolarizes the issue. We had equal representation from both parties at the event. We had a variety of political viewpoints from Bitcoiners themselves represented at the event. And so where there's a lot of Bitcoin events kind of skew in a certain direction politically, this one was balanced. And the ability to talk to people in government across political differences, educate, and to do so in a, you know, in a constructive way rather than political posturing in a public way. There were a lot of private conversations that happened at this event, probably more important than anything that happened on stage or any of the programming. Those private conversations are how we actually get people to put down their defensive mechanisms that they have and worried about how they're being perceived and just actually think through the issues in a constructive, critical way. So I think it was an extraordinary success. All credit to the organizers of the conference, David Zell and Grant McCarty, the co-executive directors of BPI, and staff at BPI. It's a tremendous amount of work to get these people in a room together. And it took months of planning. It took financial support. And I was just kind of amazed to see it all happen. And it came off very successfully.
Yeah, that's a good point you raised, Troy. I think so many in that sector in DC, we're used to hearing from politicians and like congressional testimonies and grandstanding formats. And when you bring people in a room with some Bitcoin experts on certain things and realize, oh, you know, Troy and Marco, they're pretty smart and pretty nice people. You know, you get a face to Bitcoin, you get a face to these really, really important issues we're talking about and regulators in the room. And it was kind of the perfect combo. There was a live stream available that was really great that people are slowly trickling out into the world, which is really cool. Like I remember the day of the event when I first logged in, I think it was like 60 or 70 people watching live. And then by the end, I don't know what the numbers are, but it was definitely in the multiple tens of thousands that have viewed this. And then beyond, people are slowly trickling out information. And it's this really beautiful organic way of getting out these really high signal panels that happened. It's not clickbait. It's not talking about, I think Bradley mentioned this, it's not talking about, you know, numbers or finance or even, you know, an academic conference, but it was a particular focus and staying focused on that was really, really important for this event. Not that Bitcoin necessarily needs these things or needs us in the room with politicians, but it was just the perfect balance and really just BPI, I couldn't agree more, just kind of genius in the setup of it. So I was really amazed with that. Margo, but from your end, go ahead, Troy.
No, I think Bradley said, no one mentioned price all day. Yeah. It was never mentioned once. That kind of says it all. You know, this was about Bitcoin in a much broader, way than, you know, number go up.
And Margo, I know you put a lot of work into this as well, working on the report, the presentation you were doing, all of this stuff leading up to that. You know, how was that for you? How were conversations you were having? Obviously, you've been at this for quite a few years now as the climate scientist angle and talking about this. So this isn't your first rodeo, but obviously things are building up more and more in positive directions.
Yeah, well, Troy can attest that it was very stressful for me to prepare for this. I'm certainly bugged him a number of times with my stress, but It was good. I thought that the summit went really well. I thought that David Zell and Grant McCarty, they pulled off an amazing summit, and especially in comparison to the year before when our first summit, it was still very much a Bitcoin event where we had a lot of people from the industry and the community there. And this year, it was a very different audience. People didn't I had far less people come up to me who actually knew me prior to the summit, which was a really great sign. It meant that we had brought in people who were not part of the Bitcoin world, but were somehow connected to it or interested in it and wants to learn more. And I thought that was really, really fantastic. So I don't know how they did it, but I congratulate them on achieving that. And they doubled the number of attendees as well from the first summit. And that's also fantastic. So overall, I thought it went very, very well. And I think my talk went all right. I heard it went fine. So I'm glad that I was able to, I had really good compliments on my slides. So I was really glad that I put as much effort into them as I did, because it seemed like it paid off.
Oh yeah, definitely did. Thought it was a really good presentation. I've seen it shared quite a bit as well, your presentation in particular. But touching on your presentation, before we get too far in the conversation, you know, I'm curious, when preparing something for, I don't know how long you spoke for, maybe 10, 15 minutes, maybe somewhere around that, thinking about all of the things you've got in your head constantly about Bitcoin in general, Bitcoin mining, energy, climate, how do you choose what to put in there for this particular audience? How did you come to the focus that you did? And can you touch on a couple of points? I'm going to put the stream as well for folks to go back and actually watch it, which I'd highly encourage, in the show notes. So please do that if you haven't already. But what were some of the major points you wanted to make sure to get into this report, and why, or the slides?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's very hard to pick everything that I'm thinking about and pare it down to just a 15-minute talk and make it really high level and really focus on just a few key points. That I think is the biggest challenge of all with doing this, but it's also a really great exercise at the same time. So for me, I had another talk that I had given last year about the challenges of the academic literature, Macy, like Alex DeVries's papers, and the problems with Moore et al. And Alex DeVries's work. So I had these slides. I had a couple of slides already that highlighted news articles. So I knew that the key focus of all of this should be about improving the narrative from the academic side and using data and showing how we can do that with actual data from the industry. So that was my overall framing. And then the challenge really was trying to figure out what was this actual story with the data that we collected. And that part's hard. And that takes a lot of work. And I didn't have a lot of time because we were literally like still getting data a week or two before the summit and going back and forth with the guys at Clean Incentive, because we were using them because they have access to locational marginal emissions. So they were doing the calculations on that end for us with their methodology. And it was, you know, literally even like days before the summit, I still had them run something for me and send it to me just to make sure that the version that I had in the slides was correct. And so it was a lot of work. It was like just like going through generating lots of plots, exploring the results, trying to see what is the connection between all of this. What can we share that's new that we haven't talked about before? What's the interesting, cool result? And that part was really hard. And it took us a long time to even figure that out. And Troy and I went back and forth like talking about the plots that we had and just trying to think about what is the story. And in the end, it was really, it was what we had started with at the beginning, which is we wanted to highlight flexibility. And then we realized, yeah, okay, the flexibility is in the data, in the results, and we can actually highlight an aspect of that right now. There's a lot more that we can do with it and highlight and get more detail. But the high level story is that, yeah, flexibility makes a difference. And here we have some really basic early results that have evidence of this.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I'm curious from both of you, you mentioned, obviously not divulging who and the exact contents, but I'm curious, after these presentations, Troy did a talk as well on geothermal. Can you remind me and the audience of the person who you were speaking with as well? It was an official, like the geothermal, what was her exact position again? Because it was new to me.
Yeah, the person I did a couple of interviews. One was with Brian Consalvo, who's the partner at KPMG, who wrote that ESG report. And then the other was with Lauren Boyd, who's the director of geothermal technologies at the Department of Energy. She manages a $115 million budget and interfaces with academia, with industry, with the national labs to kind of coordinate geothermal energy policy in the United States. And she was awesome. But yeah, before I go into that at all, I wanted to circle back to Margot's presentation, which Margot, you're being modest, it was a great, great presentation. Mm-hmm. And I was really proud of you and of us to see it. I hope people do share it because, Margot has done the lion's share of the work on this study, collecting data, interfacing with Clean Incentive, the conception for the study, and the analysis of the data and the narrativizing the data. It's all Margot, but I have been playing a smaller role and I've seen it through the whole process so far. And we're not done. We still have to write a report. But it's been incredibly hard to gather data from miners. And it's sometimes because they don't have the data. It's because there's no like standardized format for the data. It's sometimes because they don't want to share it. It's sometimes because miners use hosts and then those hosts don't have or don't want to share the data. It's really difficult to get a company to give you data, even if you promise them anonymity and aggregation. And Margot has been tireless in doing this for many, many months. And then when we get the data in at the last minute, it's really hard to know what to do with it. And the analysis that we had planned didn't look exactly, it was not quite making sense. And part of this is that we kind of realized that carbon accounting generally is just such a mess. And we stepped into it ourselves. And we had to step back out of the complexity of carbon accounting and say something true, say something true and comprehensible and defensible. And so there's some conceptual work there. Margot worked on the slides for many days, just paring them down. The ultimate message is like very, very simple. When you have a data center that can turn off and does turn off in response to prices or in response to agreements with the grid, demand response agreements, that helps the grid out tremendously. And it's very different from an equivalent data center, which does not shut off. So these data centers we looked at, this is just from Margot's presentation, they were down 69.5%. They were up 69.5% of the time or 95% of the time, somewhere in that range. Okay, so downtimes range from 5% to 30%, roughly. And that means a lot of carbon emissions avoided. And that's what we're trying to quantify with the locational marginal emissions of where is this power? Where is this power being curtailed and taken and when and at what times? Well, you have a flexible consumer like that. You can basically shave the peaks of demand from the grid. And those peaks are carbon intensive. And they are also the same thing that sends prices of energy sky high. And that's the same thing also that requires more infrastructure for power production. So we have an amazing story to tell if we keep it very simple. It's like when you compare an AI data center and a Bitcoin mining data center, they'll be reported in the New York Times in exactly the same way. They'll be treated by Cambridge as exactly the same thing. That's 40 megawatts of load, or that's 100 megawatts of load, whatever. But 100 megawatts is not 100 megawatts. They're radically different. If the one plant is flexible and does not add to peak, and the other plant is inflexible and demands 100% uptime, they have radically different impacts on electricity prices on carbon emissions, on grid infrastructure required to maintain that grid. And so that's the story that we're telling with the data. Simple story. Margot almost thinks it's like too simple. I mean, she's like the physics whiz. And I don't think it's too simple at all. I think the identity between different kinds of loads is built into every news story. It's built into every graphic. Even look at that like graphic that we always tout, showing the different amounts of power used by different industries. Those graphics all neglect the difference between a flexible and an inflexible load. And we are showing that that difference is enormous. And that's an apples-oranges comparison that should not be made. So I think it's an important narrative. Margot, you delivered it beautifully. It was a tremendous amount of work that went into distilling down that message. And we're going to then give the same message in a report that, in full disclosure, we're going to base on Margot's talk. The slides came first before the report.
And I did tell Troy, do you think this is too stupid, too simple? Because it just seemed kind of obvious. But then I realized it's only obvious because I spend every day of my life thinking about this. And I'm inside the little bubble. But for everybody outside of it, I realize it may not be that obvious, and they're not thinking about this stuff in the same way that I am or that Troy is. So you have to start somewhere, and it's best to start at the beginning and at the basics to get people on board. So yeah, I think it turned out to be a really great, simple, straightforward result with the study. Something that I think policymakers will be able to understand and will be able to say maybe for the first time, oh, wow, yeah, so these guys turn off sometimes, huh? Okay. I mean, it's right there. It's in the plots. It's in the data. That's not a lie. So I think it's a really good first step in the right direction.
Yeah, backing up one more thing on this. What lawmakers have been telling us is that they've heard our narrative, and they've heard the narrative from Bitcoin miners. Oh, we're flexible load. Oh, we can be helpful to the grid, but where's the data? We've got models and projections, but not data. And no one has gathered detailed data from the miners. Not really. So this is a first. We've got models from Texas A&M, from Cornell, from Chicago, and all sort of saying, hey, there could be good things here, but we are the first to provide data that says yes, and those models are based in reality.
This episode of the Progressive Bitcoiner is brought to you by Zeus. Zeus is a self-custodial Bitcoin wallet for Android and iOS. The app features a built-in Lightning node that allows you to take full control of how you make payments on-chain and on Lightning. You can easily onboard to the Lightning network and let Zeus's Lightning service provider, Olympus, do all the heavy lifting for you. Or you can get more hands-on and curate your own Lightning channels with whoever you transact with most. Zeus has best-in-class privacy and allows you to have great peace of mind when sending and receiving Lightning payments. Not only does the Zeus team not want to know how you're using your money, but they're building things in a way that they can't know. There's also a first-of-its-kind Lightning address that will allow you to receive payments 24/7 to your mobile wallet self-custodially. This is a great solution for a range of people, for those who just want to have the technical ability to set up their own infrastructure, to nomads and dissidents that need to accept donations on the move. Other Lightning wallets don't give the users this level of control. In fact, many of them operate more like bank accounts that can be revoked and ultimately lead to you losing your money. With Zeus, you're in full control of your private keys and therefore can start to take full control of your financial destiny. Save 5% on LSP fees using code TPB in the access code under LSP settings. To learn more and to learn where to download, head to zeusln.com. Yeah, and I was going to ask off of that, in terms of you both have been doing this for quite a while now, at least a few years. Where do you think we're at in this narrative, in this data collection? Did you expect that at this point in 2024, does it feel like, oh, I thought we would be a little bit further with regulators, a little bit further with some political narratives, a bit further with environmental groups? Did you think, oh, actually, we're ahead of where I thought we were? I'm curious to think, as you both, because in some regards, even me on kind of a amateur or podcaster, just kind of in this lane since I got into Bitcoin in 2021, I go back and forth. Sometimes I'm like, wow, it's crazy how far we've come. Others, I'm like, as you were saying, Margo, it's so simple. Why are we not further along with our, you know, the audience we're speaking to, with progressives, with Democrats, with people who are setting regulatory policy around climate change and trying to lead that, particularly with carbon and things like that. I'm curious your take from both your perspectives on that.
Yeah, so actually, I think that we're about where I expected us to be 2 years out, in the sense that I remember saying like 2 years ago, look, it's going to take a couple of years before we start seeing this happen, before we really start seeing examples of miners co-locating with renewable energy, miners really being flexible in decarbonizing promoting ways. And now we are starting to see that these facilities are starting to come online, like Soluna, for example, and the CEO, John Bilzar, also gave a keynote talking about that synergy there. And so I do think that we're about where I expected. The part that I didn't really expect is that I would be the person collecting the data to show everybody where we're at. That's the part I didn't plan on. I just remember saying, look, the data will come. It's going to take a couple of years. I didn't think that I was the person that was going to be the one going out, getting the data, and then sharing it as the evidence. But I remember, I don't know if it was like, it was sometime last year, telling Troy, I'm really bored with the narratives and I need to change. I need something new. I need something to talk about that isn't just what we've been saying all this time about, oh yeah, Bitcoin, it'll monetize this. It's going to help with the energy transition. It's really great for this stuff and methane mitigation. Like, I was like, okay, that's great, but that's just something we keep saying. And the only way I realized, like, the only way that I'm going to stop being bored with that is if there's actual evidence behind it. So that was partly also why we did this, because I was bored. and then on like this, like, feeling like things are like, oh, is it too simple? Part of that is because I'm also thinking about my PhD, and I'm thinking about like different audiences, and one is my advisor, and I'm often thinking, is this too simple? Is this publishable? Like, is anybody going to want to publish this? Take this seriously? You know, that's something I'm also thinking about simultaneously. So balancing those two is a challenge. But yeah, I do think we're where I expected us to be overall.
Yeah, that's a great answer, and it's a great question, Trey. And I think I've also been bored. In a way, the academic in me wants to do something new all the time. I'm not a communicator. I'm a scholar primarily, or that's how I think of myself. We're ahead on the, I think on the Bitcoin community's understanding of what's happening, we're ahead of where I thought we would be. Pretty cool. I mean, everybody knows the shtick. Bitcoiners themselves are really well educated, I would say. They've learned a tremendous amount. I include myself. We've all learned a tremendous amount about energy systems over the last couple of years, because we've been under such intense fire. On the public-facing side, I think we're behind where I would like to be and behind where I thought we might be. Our, we're still looking at a proposed 30% across the board tax proposal from the Biden administration on Bitcoin mining, which is ridiculous. It's a very powerful tool, guys. Like, let's try to use it. What's most striking about the tax proposal is that it's just blanket across the board. It doesn't recognize differences and sort of useful niches in which Bitcoin could occupy, or it doesn't distinguish between mining Bitcoin on a coal plant or using it to mitigate methane on a landfill, which have wildly different impacts on emissions. And so in other ways, I am surprised where we are as far as we are. It was wonderful to have somebody from the Department of Energy on stage at a Bitcoin policy summit in only its second year of existence. The fact that Lauren was there, she came to all the talks all day. she was very interested and open-minded in about Bitcoin itself and the intersection of what she does and what we do and whether there could be possible synergies there. That's phenomenal. Amazing that we had so many members of Congress, staffers, members of the agencies attending a Bitcoin event. Like that itself, just forget any of the content, just the fact that these people showed up to talk to us, we're in some ways much farther along. And when I think about the objections to Bitcoin and sort of what's hot right now, it's not the environmental side, even though nobody's like taken back any of their mistakes or a mistaken rhetoric. No one's issued any corrections. And I think this is since Trump, the new style. No one will ever issue any more apologies or corrections ever again, no matter how wrong they are. It's just viewed as weakness or somehow something like that now. But even though nobody has taken anything back, they just shift to another FUD point. So, you know, right now it's illicit finance, it's sanctions, it's undermining the dollar. And I think the threat to Bitcoin, if I am reading the tea leaves correctly, is not the energy side. I think Bitcoin mining is going to be fine. Not to say, you know, there's no threat there. I just don't think the momentum is there to pass any ridiculous legislation. I don't think that Biden proposal of 30% tax is going anywhere. But I do think that people are looking at a compromise from a kind of Elizabeth Warren, make crypto completely illegal in the U.S. by saying that you're just making it regulated and safe and applying the same sensible regulation you apply to banks and ignoring the fact that running a node is very different from running a bank, making it basically illegal to run a node or to mine. The compromise position there, I'm guessing, is still something that's not going to be acceptable to Bitcoiners. And it's going to involve reporting requirements and really tight regulation so that KYC AML Bitcoin is going to be different from non-KYC AML Bitcoin. And the latter is going to be difficult to operate with. It's going to be difficult to spend with it. It's going to be difficult to touch the traditional system of finance with the alternative system, and no one's really opposed to that. The number go up, people are okay because we have the ETFs. They're okay just kind of having it in this digital gold role. And so I think that's where the pressure is right now. I'm not going to rehash that issue, but the pressure has shifted from the energy issue to that issue in part because of our success in the narrative that we're telling. So in some ways that's a huge threat to Bitcoin, but it's also a marker that we've done something right.
Yeah, I totally resonate with that. And on our show recently, we've been talking a lot with you know, Kyle Schnepps, who was also there with you all, with Ludmila, yes, who was also there. So many folks that I just think are some of the smartest and coolest people that I know and connect with. And I feel a bit, just from this platform and other people I'm talking to, whether it's Paul Revere, John the Baptist, whoever, just saying like, hey, people, this is the threat. It's that complacency and number go up. I feel like Mark Goodwin is my spirit animal, talking about talking about BlockRock, talking about the ETFs, talking about like that is how Bitcoin gets captured. It doesn't get captured in the same way of any, you know, the network of mining of these things. So hammering on about human rights, hammering on about these things. And you know, I'll not beat a dead horse on this episode, like people can listen to all the other ones, but I have been extremely disappointed that more folks aren't speaking up enough about it. And again, what I've said, I said this on a recent episode too, it's not even about Bitcoin. It's more like that sort of society is not a civil society to live in. Because if you're trying to ban self-custody, if you're doing these different things, then you're banning, you're talking about free speech. You're talking about many amendments in our Constitution. In our Bill of Rights, this is not a society, but post 9/11, it's kind of, you see where these things have started. You see where this trajectory has gone. And Margot and I have talked a lot about this. A lot of concerns from the progressives I know, I'm just trying to get them and my close friends to see, hey, you see how these things in Bitcoin are talked about? Okay, expand your brain a little bit to other areas. And that's the threat we're talking about here, which can be frustrating. And back to your point too, Troy, about you were saying you feel like to the public, we're a little bit behind. I remember, so in my undergrad studying sociology and studying a lot of these, you know, philosophers and sociologists, one thing that one of my professors said to me at the time is look at all the examples of different philosophies that have gone mainstream. Sometimes it has taken 60 years. You know, you go through academia, you go through, okay, some counterculture stuff, you go through whatever corporations, whatever the field is, and then you get to how you see it playing out in society in day to day. So I sometimes take a step back and think about that in terms of Bitcoin as well. Not a direct metaphor, but you know, a lot of the things we're talking about now, will it become clear in 50, 60 years, right? And thinking of how freaking early we are in Bitcoin. And that's so hard though, because I think the three of us and so many others are so excited about the promise and potential of Bitcoin. And as Margo, you said, we're getting into some of the data to say, here, this is what we were talking about. We're starting to actually show and do what we were theoretically talking about. But that is the part that's like telling people who think Bitcoin is going to die to be patient for that to come out is really hard, because there's a lot of people still rooting it, against it. And there's those of us that are anxiously wanting it to be here today, all this potential that we see and think will come about. So it is this, I don't want to say waiting period, because there's a lot of action that's taking place. But those are the things I think about as well. I think a lot of these things are going to roll out for a very long time. I'm not trying to be bearish for people that'll say I'm being bearish. An episode with CK will have already come out by now. The most bullish person in Bitcoin, I'll probably get on my case for that. But these things are going to take some time. So I'm trying to remind myself. And then when I talk to my friends, hey, these things will take time with what we're talking about with Bitcoin.
Well, we're coming from we're coming from behind the on the energy issue. We had these early papers by DeVries. They are now cited hundreds and hundreds of times by articles, and it, you know, it's the same with Mora. They won't die. So if you get in early and you put a foothold in to the academic literature, everything gets built on top of it, and it's very hard to go after something that foundational and then rethink things, because those articles don't cease to exist. And so you have a massive peer-reviewed literature built on really garbage science. It's been a kind of a wake-up call for me, you know, as an epistemologist and philosopher of science, to see in action like how things can go awry. And then everything is downstream of that, like media is downstream of that. And Alex DeVries is on everybody's speed dial, and he's still saying the same kind of things. And activists are downstream of that. And so this becomes part of the lore. It becomes part of received wisdom. And it's really hard to undo received wisdom, because people have staked their identities on it and they anchor on it. You know, we don't rethink every question from the ground up with quote unquote first principles or whatever. Every time we have a conversation, we reflect basically our settled takes on things are foundational, and we do not rethink them. And that has happened now for a huge section of, I would say, opinion makers, you know, culture makers and leaders. I would say the elite in this country. And so undoing that, does it take a long time? Yes. How long did it take to undo attitudes on marijuana or drug laws? Or how long is it taking people to undo attitudes on nuclear power? Your estimates of time, Trey, are not far off. We had an anti-nuclear movement, you know, in the 70s that refused to update their beliefs through now. And we still have in Greenpeace and the Sierra Club virulent opponents to nuclear power while we are facing climate chaos. And nuclear represents one of the most powerful tools we have in our arsenal. When you look at decarbonization, where it has actually occurred, it's been because of nuclear, but it's just off the table because of that early FUD, and we can't actually look into the issue in depth. You're just seeing that start to change. But even in California, politicians are opposed to, you know, keeping a nuclear plant open. they were like uniformly opposed to that. It's still driven by the hangover from some early mistakes. And so we're still at that early phase, but you can see, yeah, the long road ahead we have. And what we are doing is something, in a way, I don't know, it's foundational. We are doing a different kind of information amplification and spread because we are a decentralized popular movement, right? I think the institutions that have kind of set hard against this idea will be much slower to change than the general public opinion. And shift in media from a centralized top-down form where you just hear from the establishment to a bottom-up grassroots social movement, the sort of like this podcast today, you know, gives me more hope that we don't have to go through this freaking 50-year cycle to clarify misinformation, but we can bring the heat with our own research, with our own information outlets that force the scientists and the politicians to re-examine the evidence that they would otherwise not examine.
Yeah, and I want to pull on that to a very important point for those that are listening, especially like you both. I know have had, especially you, Margo, have had activism in your background and like a deep care for the environment, for climate change, for human rights, Occupy, all of these different things. But focusing on the environmental angle, what I see from friends, and I've tried to have conversation with folks about, because I got to a place a while ago before I was into Bitcoin, where I was getting very exhausted on politics, on nothing changing, on the environment. And I got to a point, which probably made it easier for me to jump into the rabbit hole almost immediately once I really did with Bitcoin, got to a point where I'm like, I don't care about the ideology. We just need solutions like now. And I'm so angry at everyone who has said since I was a little kid, what the solutions will be, and those haven't panned out. So for both of you, kind of back to, you know, I think both of you are deep academics that have learned to speak to the common person, if you will. In your backgrounds, you're both deeply intelligent and focused on that academic work. And I think through a variety of things, you know, probably most notably like Peter's podcast, What Bitcoin Did, right? You both going on and then kind of rocketing to, whoa, this is kind of a cool, different angle. For folks like me, though, super inspirational to why I'm doing what I'm doing today, and others in environmental movements, human rights, and seeing things like this. How do you both continue going? I think in the face of FUD, in the face of hitting brick walls, in the face of seeing some of the climate data that Margo, you've been sharing recently, a lot of others have been sharing recently, that's super alarming about global ocean temperatures recently within the past 6 months. I know Willy Wu and Naden out in Hawaii and some of the islanders who are really seeing this today are focusing on that. So I think a lot of environmentalists, even separate from Bitcoin, are seeing this, right? And clearly the younger generation have just been facing like just severe depression over this type of environment. How do you both, you know, focus on this work and keep doing what you're doing? We're talking about the long haul, right? We're talking about, I think there's a deeply positive message within what we're saying, but there's a lot of work and a lot of time that we're doing here. I'm sure both of you have just faced like, wow, how do I, this is just crazy. It's overwhelming. How do you keep going? How do you stay positive in this?
So this morning I was just listening to a clip from Peter Kalmus on Democracy Now! And Peter is at JPL, my old stomping ground. And he's a climate scientist. He's far more of a climate scientist than I think I will ever be. But he's also a climate activist. And I think the thing that really depresses me about the climate movement is that they're still stuck in this mindset of we have to get government to do something or else there's no hope. And he was saying, you know, we need more people getting arrested because he himself has been arrested at a climate action before in the past. And I think, yeah, but, you know, getting arrested is, of course, is a way to bring attention. And of course, civil disobedience, there are benefits to it in bringing attention to your cause. But I think at this point that the best thing that we can do is to actually take action and apply ourselves to solutions and try to figure out what we can do without thinking that government is going to solve it for us, because we're in such a really difficult situation. And the promise of government figuring it out and doing the right thing is really, really, really low, I think. So I for myself, I just think that so long as I am working on practical solutions and trying to make those practical solutions possible, I'm doing the best that I can, and that keeps me going. But I also am so frustrated and aware of the looming threats of tipping points and the fact that we don't fully understand why we have this recent jump in sea surface temperature, right? Like that it's increased significantly, very much above normal. And there's James Hansen, basically like the grandfather of climate change. He's been putting out reports and studies with, and not just on his own, co-authored with many people, talking about the possibility of acceleration of warming and the various potential causes, and how we really need to even look beyond the models in the IPCC because they're too conservative and in some ways they're wrong, and that we should really be focused on the paleoclimate data, which is like old, you know, actually like empirical, going out collecting data from different biological sources that are actually in, you know, like earth dated, right? And looking at the past climate and seeing what does that, you know, if global warming happened at some point in the past, what happened after that? It's in the earth record. What does that mean for us, for warming for us? It doesn't look that great if we continue on a trajectory of not taking strong immediate action. And I think knowing that it's also very challenging to organize governments behind that action, it's a big deal. It's a big thing to think about and try to accept and figure out, okay, what are the worst case scenarios here? One of them being the AMOC collapsing. And that's like a circular cycle of water and heat and throughout the Atlantic. And you know, if that collapses, those effects are going to be felt very, very severely in parts of the globe, and it'll happen over decades or hundreds of years, but it could happen, you know, within 50 years, let's say, the AMOC collapse. The AMOC may already be in a process of collapsing. We don't know it. So I'm getting into like really doomer climate stuff. But I was thinking about this morning, and I really wanted to talk about it. So I'm going to take up all this time to be my climate activist self and talk about it and say, you know, the biggest challenge is that we cannot solve this in the way that we wish we could solve it. And I really wish climate activists like Peter Kalmus would accept that reality. And I think they may feel it inside, but they're not ready to accept it. And I think that's where the conflict is. And we have to accept it, that the government is not going to come in time to solve it in the decades time that we need. It's just not possible. So we have to think, okay, how can we solve this in a practical way by ourselves? And even if you're on the left, and even if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter and you call yourself a democratic socialist, the only way we can do it is with the market, friends. This was Noam Chomsky. This is what Noam Chomsky said. I asked him, I sent him an email personally, and I said, "Dear Professor Noam Chomsky, if we do this, don't you think we're going to extend the lifetime of capitalism?" And he said, "Yes, but we have no choice. We have to do it within the system that we have." And so I accepted that, and I agree. We have to use the market, and we have to utilize it and exploit it as much as possible. And the one way that we can do this is with Bitcoin. And this is where I tie into Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin, nobody owns Bitcoin. It's money. It's decentralized, distributed network. The protocol is open sourced. So far, you know, we can find our on and off ramps are not closed off, and we can keep working on that to prevent that from being possible. But if you can use Bitcoin, one, we can find a way to organize with money that is not controlled by the opposition, those who support fossil fuels and support destroying our planet. And two, We have this really interesting technology called Bitcoin mining that has these really cool second order effects that we can utilize to help provide, to monetize the build out of renewable energy. It can be an off taker of last resort, and it can help in some ways with mitigating carbon emissions. Like we've shown, it's pretty cool. It can power on and off very quickly, and you can co-locate it. You can put it on landfills. You can put it at pig waste sites, whatever, right? You can then capture the heat and you can displace natural gas. Like, there's all these really cool things, and it's all market. It's all through the market. The government doesn't even understand it and would, in some ways, would like to stop it. So here is a cool way, like one cool way where we can build a whole possible exit and a new way of thinking about the world. And it is a free market tool. And why say no to it just because the word market is in there when it can actually help us as climate activists who care, who want system change, not climate change? So that's how I feel. I don't get to talk about this that much these days because I'm so focused on data, but it's all still in there, guys. I still feel very strongly about this, and I'm very worried, but I keep trying to do something good.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bitbox. Now, Bitbox is a hardware wallet that's open source, incredibly secure and easy to use, and it's what I'm using to safely secure my Bitcoin in cold storage. Now, I know self-custodying Bitcoin can really be intimidating, but Bitbox is designed for ease of use without compromising on security. It's USB-C compatible and allows you to easily back up and restore your private keys with a micro SD card, which is really cool. Now, you can purchase the Bitbox using the promo code TPB at the link found in the show notes for 5% off your purchase. And I really want to thank Bitbox for their support of the podcast, and I'm really excited about this new partnership. All right, I'll let you get back to the episode now.
That was incredible. That is one of the best clips we'll have of this show right there. That I will spread out. Go off, Margo. That was great. Troy, I don't I'm sure you agree with that, really.
I can't really follow that, but I'll say a few things that, I mean, just about my own personal journey. I was a standard kind of environmentalist until, late 2000s. I mean, a sort of a Green Party guy, actually. I wasn't Democrat. I was a Green Party person. And then I was teaching at Oxford, and one of my colleagues there is a Chinese historian, and we had dinner all the time in college. And he said to me one day, he was like, I was giving him some scheme or other that I had invented. Oh, yes, my scheme was a money scheme. It was a scheme for, I've told Margo about this, it was a scheme for money that would solve climate change, where basically the money supply is all linked to your ability to extract fossil fuels. So you decide on the carbon budget of the planet, and then you give each person like the right to extract their amount, their proportion of fossil fuel that keeps us under carbon budget as a planet. And then energy companies can buy your right to drill, essentially. And that's like a universal basic income for you. It has to be enforced nationwide. And this is the only way you can drill is with these credits. You have to buy them from ordinary citizens. I mean, I still think it's kind of a cool idea. But if you think about what it would take to implement, it's absolutely insane. It would require worldwide totalitarian control and agreement. And we know this, just like, this has 0% chance of happening. And if it did, probably the system that it came with would be incredibly repressive. You know what I mean? So it was like, it's a philosopher's thought experiment. Anyway, this Chinese historian was like, Troy, doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter what conversations we have around this table. Like, China is going to produce enough global warming gases to like doom the planet all on their own. They're exploding. And this was, 2010. So they were exploding. And I was like, this sounds kind of like a Republican talking point. And he's like, no, it's the math. They're going to eclipse us economically. And then he's like, we just live in a broader world that's not going to obey whatever political scheme we cook up. And I had this similar kind of confirmation of this when I was just flying over Mexico City. And I looked down at the city and I was just reading this climate stuff. And I just looked down out of the plane window and I saw that, you know, millions of people spread below me, most of them living not as well as they want to live and not as well as most Americans live. And I just thought, there's just no fucking way. Like, there's no way they're going to be like, okay, let's buy into your global eco-socialism. That sounds good to us. No, they're going to build fossil fuel plants and they're going to build an economy and a life like ours. That's what's going to happen. That's what's going to happen. And you can do it over Johannesburg. You can do it over Lima. You can go anywhere in the global South and you're going to have the same exact feeling, a gut check time. You know, it's not about like, and then, okay, third data point. I'm at Reed College, called the most progressive college in America. We're meeting with the architects for the college, the 2050 plan. And we're looking at where to build new buildings for 2050. And somebody says, the architect says, well, there's a parking lot here and we could put our next building in the parking lot because the zoning is very easy for that. And a professor, one of the chairs of the department's like raises her hand and says, but I think that we need that parking because we got to walk to our offices and I don't want to have to park farther away so that I have a longer walk to my office. And I think that might lead more professors to like not come in as much and that would hurt the college. And I wrote to the president of the college afterwards and I was like, here's the projected like temperatures in Portland in 2050. Our weather's going to look like, there are different projections, but our weather could look like, Arizona's weather, or it could look like California's weather. Our beloved canyon, which is full of Douglas firs, will be at a very high risk of forest fire because it won't have the wet, cold climate that we have now to sustain it. And we're talking about not wanting to walk farther from a parking lot. So it's not just Mexico City and Johannesburg that aren't going to accept this kind of constraint on our personal lives and freedom that it would really take to reduce emissions, like through cutting consumption, and from a top-down mandate. If even Reed College, like people can't stomach a slightly longer walk from a parking lot, it ain't happening, right? And so then you flip over into this kind of doomer mindset where you're just like, ah, fuck it, you know, just enjoy it. Life is short. Stoicism. We just brave, you know. To some extent, I did make that shift, just like the fuck it, fuck it, you know. And that became my motto. Like, well, this is just not happening. When you look at what needs to change and people's willingness to change, and then I came through that to the other side. Wait a minute. First of all, every degree matters. Every tenth of a degree, every hundredth of a degree matters, and in fact, matters a lot. Right now, we've had a lot of warming already. I don't know. My life's still pretty good. I know there's people who've suffered from it, climate change. I know we have impacts in various places, but life is still pretty good. But if we hit a threshold, it starts getting very, very bad. You know what I mean? So it's like, even if things get worse, how much worse they get matters a lot. Every tenth of a degree is worth fighting for. And then the other thing is a kind of you reject this idea of you're either going to save the world or the world's going to fail. No, you're trying to be responsible with your life. And whether or not that succeeds doesn't matter. I mean, whether or not it succeeds doesn't matter. That's a kind of like Viking mentality. You go to battle. It doesn't matter whether you live or die. You do your duty. Your duty does not change depending on your chance of survival, right? So just take like the Viking mentality, the Stoic mentality, but don't let it stop you from action. And then think about actions that will actually work and be effective. And to Margot's point, once you realize that collective action on this scale, the global scale, that it's not likely to happen, especially because given global trade, the defectors have an advantage. You know, if you don't participate in this scheme, you get a huge leg up. And so given, and every individual player has all incentive to cheat you know, to say they are emitting less than they do. And socialism is not a cure. If we look at like communist governments, they're not like the best stewards of the environment. In fact, they do some of the worst pollution. Right? There isn't a scheme of government that solves it. And I won't add to Bitcoin's or to Margot's amazing scree about Bitcoin and how it holds potential, except to say, you know, some of the idea that brought me and the public as a Bitcoiner that I wrote up with Andrew Bailey was a way in which you could do something positive, environmentally positive with Bitcoin by adding to hash rate and mining in a responsible and environmentally and socially positive way. Like, that's cool. If anybody gives me a lever that I can push as an individual that is doable, especially one that may be even profitable, I'm going to do it regardless of the big picture. Just forget the big picture. Tend your own garden. And for me, that means trying to use Bitcoin in pro-social, pro-environmental ways. And that's why I'm, you know, advising the companies that I'm advising. Every company that I advise shares that mission with me. I want them to succeed. And I think I can get more done that way than by wagging my finger and trying to shame people, whether it's my colleagues at Reed or whether it's the entirety of the global South. Hey, you shouldn't be using as much energy. That's just not going to do anything. I'd rather build something, make something. And finally, one last word is that Bitcoin has provided an amazing community. And you know, this side of Bitcoin, particularly the Margot side and Margot herself, when you find people who feel the same way as you and are taking action, Harold Router, you know, Nate Harmon, these people fill me with tremendous hope and keep me encouraged. If I were just like a solo individual out here trying to do this, I would be discouraged. I think Bitcoiners who don't believe in climate change at all, but are friendly with me and manage to find common ground with me, that gives me tremendous hope. I'm like, oh, people are not just locked in a death match based on ideology, but we can actually connect on the points we agree on, set aside the points we disagree on, disagree about them civilly, and work together on what we do agree on. That's also incredibly, incredibly hopeful.
Yeah, the remarks from both of you. I have nothing more to add to that. You said a point, Troy, that I...
Well, then I'll add something. No, just kidding.
Well, I was going to say, and yes, please, Mario. Well, Troy, you said one thing that I've been thinking for a while. When I first got into Bitcoin and in the space, I think I might have been a bit more angsty towards the Bitcoin community and it's come a long ways even since 2021, but very much trying to speak my mind and be like, I'm getting a lot of flack for being progressive, being on the left, yada, yada. Okay, so come full circle. Now what I'm slowly realizing is, to your point, where there are people in Bitcoin or online Bitcoin, which is the 5% fringes of either extreme, right, that might not believe in climate change, but many of them are doing more to address climate change or take climate action by investing in Bitcoin mining. So I'm like, whether you like it or not, we can agree on that. I don't care what your reason is. It goes back to that market. It goes back to solutions. I'm like, I would rather that than someone who is not taking effective action that makes change that I might ideologically agree with on that point. So again, I'm so focused on the action point, as you both are talking about, that I'm like, hey, that's fine. That's fine if you think the world is flat and that climate change is real, whatever. Hey, we're on the same team with Bitcoin mining. That's pretty cool to me. That's very cool. Margot, were you going to jump in and say something?
Well, I mean, to your point, I think that's like what's very cool about Bitcoin, and is that you don't have to care about something, but because of how the protocol is designed, the incentives are designed, you end up doing something potentially positive, whether you intended to or not. So if we could take that and extend that across the entire world to every single problem that we had, we would solve all of our problems very quickly. But it seems that the rest of the world is not as simple as Bitcoin. I wanted to say about some things that Troy said. One is, you know, his point is like, you just kind of have to do the right thing. And I think whether you succeed or not is also a really one of my favorite points, that Chris Hedges makes. He's a really fantastic journalist. And Chris Hedges has said time and time again, like, we do these things not because we expect to win, but because it's the right thing to do. Ethically and morally, it's the right thing to do. So that's why we do what we do. That's what, even in spite of the odds, and even just thinking about Bitcoin in general and the overall idea behind it, and like, there are really big odds against Bitcoin's success. And however way you imagine what that success will be, the odds are very, very big. But we do it because we think that it's the right thing to do, and we're really hoping that it is. But, you know, you do it because it's just what you should do, not because you think you might win. And I think that's fundamentally how we have to always approach these really, really big issues. And then also, I thought, I had not mentioned David Graeber on your show today, so I should mention him because
at least once. Yeah.
It's a rule that I have to mention Graeber at least once on your show. And that's to the point that we all have the ability to do something, and it's like, you don't have to wait for somebody else to do it. You should just do it. And that's, I think, a really nice, like, anarchist view is like, you know, there's infinite ideas, right? There's infinite, because there's every person is different. Everybody has an idea. And I think if you just let people decide for themselves, make the choices on their own without coercing them, then you'll find that they'll eventually, you know, they'll make the right choice. So I think we should not try to find solutions or lean towards solutions that are more top-down or centralized authority just because they're the most efficient ones. I think that that can lead us down paths that are dangerous. And I think that we should really focus on letting people organize and decide for themselves how they think society should be. So... yeah. Well, David Graeber.
Yeah, I think just to touch on that point, Margot, I think the shift towards authoritarianism within the left is frightening. And it feels historically naive to me. It feels very historically naive. And because those movements never go the way they expect to go. And the story behind every authoritarian regime is, you know, we need to take these levers of power. We need to deprive individuals of rights in order to get something important done. And we have a really great person generally, you know, or people who can do this. And it just never goes as promised. And I feel like in the U.S., the Trump dynamic just makes it far worse because it feels like Trump is willing to pull any lever that's available and consolidate power. And so this feeds into the left's already that feeling that they need to do the same. Otherwise, it's like asymmetric warfare. You know, if you're trying to protect individual liberties and rights and your opponent is happy to grab levers of power wherever they are, you feel you're at a disadvantage. And the threat to the threat to them feels so real. They're just ready to react. So I feel like on both sides of the political spectrum, there's a comfort with drastic actions, top-down actions. And it really pains me to see environmentalism as the rationale for authoritarian power grabs. A lot of people in Bitcoin will say that the climate narrative is a hoax because it's just a ruse to grab power. And I always say back, like, it's not a hoax. But that doesn't mean it can't be a mechanism of grabbing power. I mean, of course it can. It would be foolish to think it isn't. What's weird is when the left really leans on climate change as a reason for infringements on liberty, they play right into that narrative that denies even the reality of climate change, because the right has pushed them together. They've pushed together the denial of climate with this power grab. And when you try to grab power and you're just overt about it, you actually undermine the credibility of the problem itself, because people see through the power grab and that's all they see. And so, you know, watching this unfold, it's very painful, very painful. People cannot keep these two thoughts distinct. Like the atmospheric chemistry doesn't care who's trying to grab what levers of power or what, you know, what narratives are being told about it. It's a physical process. It's not a social process. So, yeah, please just keep those distinct in your mind, the scientific question, the political question, but also be aware that other people are meshing them together, and that your purported solutions on the political front, particularly when they're coming from like the Davos crew, you know, are just going to cause people not to see the scientific problem accurately. It's hard to watch.
Yeah, and I think, you know, wrapping up here, because I know Troy has a hard stop here. And
I have to go.
Yeah. And this conversation could keep going. The absolutely brilliant. Just echo all of your points. That's, you know, our small hope through this platform is just to, from the beginning, I was like, I see progressives in the left being captured by these narratives that we fled from the right with Donald Trump. So my hope is just bringing back that sense of solutions and things we're talking about to progressives who will listen, anyone who will listen to us, but progressives in the left. And on your point, what was interesting recently was Max Keiser was talking about this quite a bit, who some people from the left or some others, there are many things I would disagree with Max Keiser, but Max Keiser was going out against a lot of climate denying Bitcoiners recently on social media, on Twitter X, saying like, you know, oh, wow, the leftists, they really got to you, Max. And Max is like, no, you all are idiots. This is real. Follow the money, follow the data. This is real. Bitcoin can be a solution. And I like rubbed my eyes like a cartoon character. I was like, am I really seeing this? I think Evan from our team sent a message, and I was like, he was like, this wasn't on my bingo card. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And followed it. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is where we're at. Like Max Keiser is talking about climate change and how Bitcoin actions, that was really cool to me. But anyway, Troy, Margo, thank you so much for jumping on. What's hysterical is that we didn't even touch on the halving, right? I'm going to let people know about the halving and data. We'll talk about that with other guests and stuff, but are there any final remarks from both of you in this incredible episode for our audience?
I just want to second what you said about Max. Max is an independent thinker, and he's got fuck you money. He doesn't care what people think about him. I mean, he to be fair, he didn't care what people thought about him from the very beginning. I don't always agree with Max. Sometimes he said things that were, wow, over the line. But both Margo and I watched Max in the early years talking about Bitcoin, and it was wild back then. He's kind of a prophet. It was really, really cool to see him hold his ground against the mob in the same completely defiant and unapologetic way that he deals with every other issue. It was awesome. Go, Max.
Yeah, definitely. Max is... some of the things he said lately, yeah, definitely stuff that I question. But yeah, it was a long time hero of mine. I learned a lot of economics from the Keiser Report. So I do think that he's a really brilliant person. And so it actually doesn't surprise me that he is not a climate denier, because he's always brought people, progressives, onto his show, especially, you know, what you'd call like progressive economists like Michael Hudson and Steve Keen have been on the show many, many times. And he was totally aligned with the Occupy movement when that happened. So I see Max as some ideologically separate from right or left. You know, I think ideologically he's in the right place. He just has some like crazy political ideas as well, because he's a brilliant guy, so he's also crazy, which is normal. But yeah, I was really thrilled, though, that he was talking about this, and especially talking about like the insurance companies, because this is something that I've been thinking about for a while as well, and was literally telling my mother about this like 2 days prior to his tweet about it, the insurance signal, which I think of it as a signal, which is like when people are going to realize that they're in trouble is when they cannot get insurance for their homes or for their property or whatever, because the insurance industry is not, are not climate deniers, and they're not going to cover you if there's a fire or a flood, right? So I thought, finally, and also it was great because somebody else could take the heat for once, and a bigger person, you know, bigger personality can take the heat, because I'm usually getting the only one getting attacked for saying things like that. So I felt like that was great to see somebody else say these things. And he, you know, he was saying climate chaos. He wasn't just like, oh yeah, climate change. He was like, it's climate chaos. Like, all right, right, Max, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this conversation feels like we need to put a pin in it and continue this another time. But I want to thank you both for all of your contributions to everything you're working on, for focusing on ethics, focusing on the right things, focusing on just doing it, just like you both were saying, just doing it, and just going out there, for all your incredible work and influence on people that are listening, to myself. So thank you both so much. You get all the credit that you deserve. And thanks for coming on the show. Out of your busy schedules, you've been traveling a lot recently, so I hope you get a little time to relax. I know, Troy, you've got to go meet with students, but hopefully you can relax at some point soon.
Thank you, Trey. It's really nice to be here. Really nice to have this discussion, Margo and you.
Yes, it's great. It's always great to be on a panel or a talk or a podcast with Troy, especially. I love doing that. So yeah. Thank you, Trey, for making this possible.
Absolutely.